5.
We need to act now while we still can to actually, as I say, use our majority, use our mandate and do what is necessary to stop the boats.
The Prime Minister's tried to cram more Conservative policies into one week than anyone's managed for the last decade.
Sunak's got it through the Commons. Will it work? Will it deliver any electoral benefit for the Tories?
Chickers to the front, Mr. Halligan.
With a zig a zig ha, whatever that means.
One. We have liftoff.
Welcome once again to Planet Normal, the Telegraph podcast with Alison Pearson.
Hello.
And me, Liam Halligan. MPs are back at Westminster, Alison. And we've got a great show lined up here on the Rockets of Right Thinking. No less than citizens of Planet Normal deserve. For one thing, Rishi Sunak's much-discussed, much-delayed Rwanda bill is now an act, having finally passed through both the Commons and the Lords. But will the Prime Minister's flagship policy actually work and stop the small boats? Co-pilot Pearson's bagged an interview with a former Tory Home Secretary, whose views may upset Number 10. Then there's the row over the future of Mark Rowley. Should the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, just 18 months into the job, stand down? Given the row over Gideon Falter, a campaigner against anti-Semitism who has moved on, threatened with arrest no less, at a recent pro-Palestine rally in central London. Mr. Falter's alleged crime, looking, quotes, openly Jewish. You've written passionately on this subject, Alison. Link in the show notes to this episode. Petrol prices are soaring, now back over £1.50 a litre. More for diesel, as oil prices remain high amidst geopolitical tensions. What does that mean for inflation and interest rates? My old mate Frank Field, former Labour MP for Birkenhead, has sadly died. We'll be talking about him. And we have some exciting news too, about Planet Normal itself. Brace yourself. But first, Alison, let's forget about highfalutin politics and economics, because surely, surely, the most important event of the last week is this. Victoria Beckham, a.k.a. Posh Spice, has turned 50. And you said it took you back to a dim and distant past when you once had fun times with the Spice Girls. Who knew?
Chickers to the front, Mister Halligan.
With a zig a zig ha,
with a zig a zig ha. Planet Normal doesn't normally go down to this level, does it really? But
what do you mean? Well, it's the popular culture we know and love.
Well, yeah, Victoria's turning 50, and a few fraught relations between the girls over the years. Let's put it that way. But they all turned out for Posh's birthday party. David Beckham even got a little video clip of them miming to Stop, which was really, really great. And it reminded me that 26 years ago for the Telegraph magazine, went to meet them in Madrid. And they were, God, Liam, we forget, they were huge.
They were massive.
They were absolutely, what a phenomenon. I mean, it was every little girl knew all of the routines. And I got to hang out with them for a bit. And I can confirm from having sat in on rehearsals that Mel C was certainly the one who could sing. Victoria couldn't hold a note, but that hasn't held her back.
She was known as Posh Spice because her old man had a Rolls Royce.
That's right. That's right. I think.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
He'd done very well in electrical business, actually, but
she
hadn't yet married David, and all the girls, all the other Spice Girls were saying they wanted to be the bridesmaids. And you could see the look, the pained look on Victoria's face as she imagined having these sort of rampant, crazy bunch of chipmunks turning up to ruin her very exclusive Posh wedding.
They were more innocent times, weren't they? Not just because we were both younger, but just because there was a lot of hope around in the country. It was the period of Cool Britannia.
Yeah.
It was the late 90s. British tunes were dominating world pop music. There was a sense, I think, of optimism at that time. And I remember writing up for the FT, no less, even the FT, the Spectator interview with Jerry Spice, in which she basically came out as a Tory.
Jerry, who's always a slightly brazen character, bold, and she said that Margaret Thatcher was the first Spice Girl, which made headlines, which is very funny. And Jerry, of course, I think stitched together from a few Union Jack tea towels, the famous Union Jack dress, which she wore to the Brit Awards. It was interesting to look back and to think about the kind of buoyancy then. I think we're at a pretty low time now. So I suggested a menopausal Spices reunion or perimenopausal Spices reunion because it was a more sort of cheerful, upbeat time.
Because they espoused girl power, feminism light plus Botox plus platform shoes.
Yes.
There you go. There it is.
But I did ask them all those years ago about the feminism. Let's say they had a slightly shaky grasp of what it meant. But Mel B, who is rather fabulous, but was
Scary Spice.
Look at this, look at that. Yeah, she was Scary Spice, yeah.
She could sing a bit, as could Jerry Halliwell, fair play, and even Baby Spice. But it is true that Victoria Adams has said in interviews, I was so bad, most of the time they kicked my mic turned off.
Yes. I think this is why she may be kiboshing the great comeback, because A, she doesn't need the cash because she's got David. Also, I think her talents as a fashion designer may slightly outweigh her talents as a pop star. But anyway, no, it was fun to be reminded of it. It was a very, very sweet time.
So on to Rwanda. Difficult policy. Sunak's got it through the Commons. Will it work? Will it deliver any electoral benefit for the Tories?
We were laughing earlier. It's certainly been a week when the Prime Minister's tried to cram more conservative policies into one week than have been anyone's managed for the last decade. So you can see the drumbeat of the election getting nearer as they suddenly realise they're not going to have any.
They're like buses. You wait 2 years for one of them three come along.
Absolutely. Let's get some defence. Let's deport some immigrants. Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's a very fraught piece of legislation, isn't it? It's intended as a deterrent. As you said at the top, we have Suella Braverman later is going to give her take on it. Listeners will remember that Suella, Robert Jenrick and others have left the government warning that the bill, now about to be the Safety of Rwanda Act, was just not watertight enough for the flood of appeals that's going to come in. So we're going to have thousands and thousands of legal challenges. I think if they get any flights off the ground, they'll probably be largely symbolic, not very full. And I have heard they've had a lot of trouble persuading airlines to take the job. I guess that the view of many people, like the former Home Secretary and Immigration Minister, is basically, if we don't leave the European Convention on Human Rights, then British courts, via our own Human Rights Act, will just have to be dealing with endless appeals against deportation. But I think something that caught my eye, Liam, was that when Sunak was giving his Stop the Boat speech on Monday, they slipped out these new figures showing that illegal arrivals were up 24% so far this year. I mean, these are catastrophic figures. And even if they did manage to get a couple of flights by July off the ground to Rwanda, my understanding is those flights would basically take about, you know, half a Saturday afternoon's worth of the people who were coming ashore. So my own feeling is, will it work? No. It's Sunak's desperate trump card now, because we've got the local elections on May the 2nd. And of course, after that, he may well face challenges. So it's all hanging on this for him.
We will pick that up again after we hear your excellent exclusive interview with the former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, because I wanted to ask you about your thoughts, again, which you've outlined in the Telegraph, on this row over Mark Rowley. I think this is an issue which pertains to the whole country, not just London. There are pro-Palestine protests going on all over the country. And of course, there are many members of Britain's Jewish community, which is a relatively small community, 300,000, 350,000 or so, across the country, who are deeply alarmed by these protests, certainly their frequency, and certainly in central London, where the protests have been pretty much fortnightly for a long time now. And we both know, don't we, good Jewish friends of ours who don't like to come into central London when those protests are happening.
That's right. And I did write about it this week, that I was invited by my friend Gary Mond, who's the chairman of the National Jewish Assembly. And a few weeks ago, the National Jewish Assembly were holding a debate on Zoom. And the motion was, this assembly believes there is a long-term future in Britain for Jews. And I have to say, Liam, it was quite upsetting and moving to see these faces after faces coming up on the screen, very worried looking people. Of course, for almost all of them, our country is their birthplace. It's our mutual homeland. Some had fled as small children from war-torn Europe. But in the main, Britain is their country. So this idea that the discussion they're having now, should we stay, should we go, is deeply upsetting to them. And I must say that the younger people taking part, I would say people in their 30s and 40s, were doing what's known as in the community as making aliyah, that is taking themselves off to Israel.
Which every Jew has the right to go back to Israel, don't they?
Every Jew has the right to go to Israel, and they're warmly welcomed there with support and a package of help and so on. But some of them were very angry and upset, and they'd witnessed not just the marches, which of course have really poisoned the mood, but have seen a rise in schools, in universities. Lots of synagogues have had extra guards. Jewish schools are doing training for that sort of training for if that, you know, a gunman or a knifeman breaks in and so on. So it was very upsetting for me to see, particularly like a young father saying, we can't stay. The Muslim population is growing exponentially. It won't be safe for us here.
All that's true, Alison, and that's reflected in many phone calls, drinks, conversations I've had with Jewish friends as well. But there is a school of thought, isn't there, again, from within the Jewish community, that's been expressed by quite a few journalists now, and also expressed by John Mann, Lord Mann, who is the government's anti-Semitism advisor, obviously a proud member of the Jewish community himself, a very prominent member of the Jewish community. And they say it was too provocative. It was too provocative for a man to stand wearing his kippah, his traditional Jewish skull cap proudly, right next to the protests. That's really difficult to police, isn't it?
I take a different view, Liam. You can find on YouTube the actually very nice police sergeant talking to Gideon Falter and saying, look, you are quite openly Jewish, and this is a pro-Palestine march. I'm not accusing you of anything, but I'm worried about the reaction to your presence. And then he volunteered to walk Gideon Falter over to an area where there were Israeli flags. And he actually said to him, I think it was another officer joined in and said, if Gideon Falter refused to move away from or trying to cross the road through the protest, he would be arrested for a breach of the peace because his presence was antagonizing. Now, for me, this is quite an extraordinary thing to say to an individual. It's a free country. He's a free person. You can't say to someone, your actual Jewishness is a provocation. And the comparison that I have drawn is years ago, we would have trials and arrests where a young woman or woman had been raped, and she would be told that she had been dressed provocatively. So to some extent, she was asking for it. Now, that is an entirely discredited point of view now, and rightly so. It was absolutely disgusting. But what I think Gideon Falter was trying to prove is that the authorities say, this is a peaceful march, nothing to fear here, not at all anti-Semitic, despite the fact we've seen the most appalling language and so on. So I think what he was showing was there basically that those coppers were admitting, we are worried for your safety if you stay here. Now, the point here to be made is that nobody in this country, in their own capital city, should be worried for their safety just because of their clothing or ethnicity. And indeed, if he had been black or Asian, then there would have been an almighty row about it. And I think Sir Mark Rowley, Metropolitan Commissioner, and the Met have been policing this not in a law and order way, but in an appeasement way. And we are tipping, Liam, I'm afraid, towards mob rule. I think it's getting very, very serious now. And a couple of days ago, we saw the rally for St. George's Day in Whitehall. white working class lads, treated with a kind of tremendous force by the police, in stark contrast to the way that these increasingly upsetting marches have been policed with, I would say, extreme nervousness, not to mention fear. I don't think the police think they could control them if they kicked off. So it's basically about keeping the lid on it, and let's tell the Jews not to come anywhere near in case they get attacked. And before I hand back to you, let me just say that last week you may have seen an American woman was in London, and there was someone walking along with a swastika on a placard, and the young woman complained to a police officer and said, "Why aren't you arresting that person?" And he said that a swastika had to be seen in context. And that, I think, is probably gives you a really good snapshot of what's happened now. There is no context in which a swastika is acceptable. And for me, there is no context in which a person being told by a copper that they're openly Jewish and they better get out of the way because a lot of these people might attack them. That is not keeping the peace. That is appeasing bad people.
You've made those arguments just now, and also in your really passionate Telegraph column on this subject, which all Planet Normal listeners should read if they haven't already. The link is in the show notes to this episode. I'll tell you briefly what I think. I think there are definitely questions to be answered about two-tier policing. As some politicians have highlighted, their concerns initially dismissed. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that later. And I completely agree with you. Mark Rowley's future as Met Police Commissioner is now very much in the balance. This is playing out in the court of public opinion, an issue which really is at the nexus of so many difficult issues, not just the politics of the Middle East, not just the response by the horrendous attack of the 7th of October, and indeed over Israel's retaliation for that in Gaza. But I think what's absolutely certain amidst all this doubt, that this incident has led to a much more forceful debate now about whether or not these very regular, fortnightly, as I say, really big pro-Palestine rallies should be allowed in the heart of London with the regularity with which they're currently taking place. Everyone cherishes our right to protest in this country. Everyone, certainly everyone who appears on this podcast, I'd say, cherishes the importance of free speech. But I would agree with you very heartedly on this question of, have these protests gone too far? And I think that debate has certainly swung in the favour in the aftermath of these discussions about whether Gideon Falter was being openly provocative and how the Met Police reacted in the heat of the moment. Within that, I think the weight of argument has definitely swung towards, do we really need to have so many protests that are so provocative so regularly when it clearly really alarms many, many members of another minority?
Well said, but I also think that just non-Jewish people are heartily sick of it now. I get lots, I'm sure you do, I get lots of emails from listeners and from readers. They won't come up to London on a Saturday. They don't like it. They don't want to be there. They find it incredibly off-putting. So I'm wondering, just from a retail point of view, are these marches now actually starting to affect business in London and for restaurants and hospitality and so on, which is so important? As you say, there's a tradition, very passionate tradition of free speech, but there's a British tradition of, you know, you've had your turn, you know, we've heard what you've got to say, just pipe down. And I think it's dominating now, and I think it's slightly daring the government, daring the police to strike them down. And also, Liam, let's not forget that France and Germany, within a week, 10 days of the 7th of October massacres, they banned these pro-Palestine marches. I believe the Netherlands did it as well, Scandinavia. Other countries are not having these mass displays of either pro-Gazan sympathy. And I know there's a strong element of people being incredibly upset about the death toll in Gaza, but also now flagrant anti-Semitism, which sits very ill with our community. And I do wonder how many Jews will be left in 25, 30 years. And you know, we both have Jewish friends, but certainly Jews have been an absolute ornament to British life, astonishing contributions in everything from showbiz, the arts, science, medicine, law, everywhere. They've been model citizens. I mean, you know, models of integration. And what a tragedy it would be if we lost some of our most extraordinary citizens because they were scared to be here. And that upsets me as a British person.
And finally, Alison, just before we move on, let's talk briefly about defence, another sudden Tory policy from Rishi Sunak.
Yes.
He wants to spend an extra 75 billion quid on defence, says Rishi Sunak, taking the UK's defence spending to 2.5% of GDP, up from around 2% now, albeit only by 2030, Alison. But as you say, attempting to put clear blue water between the Tories and the Labour Party, probably much too little, much too late.
There's a sort of better late than never feeling as well, isn't there? I mean, Planet Normalist is being told every week that we've got a defence special coming. But
I can see it. I can see the head.
Co-pilot Pearson, as you know, is mugging up on all kinds of defence systems and Polaris submarines. And I'm out of my depth.
I saw you in khaki the other day.
I know.
Private Benjamin.
It's very much Private Benjamin, actually. Yeah, I mean, you thought I was out of my depth with epidemiology. This is a whole other ballgame. But we are in discussion with some very eminent soldiers, sailors and airmen, and we'll be bringing you that soon. But look, Liam, it's a very, very serious situation, and defence has been allowed to fall shamefully into neglect. I'm told by some of my senior chaps that we could barely have a war with Turkey, never mind with any of the more serious powers. So we've always been known for our soldiering. That's one of the things that we excel at, and that has been allowed to fall into disrepair. Just one thought. Rishi has said that Europe as a whole must spend more on defence to keep the United States committed to NATO. And I suspect that that is a major consideration here, because you'll remember that Donald Trump, not inconceivable that Trump, if he can escape from the sweaty embrace of Stormy Daniels to become the next president of the United States. Actually, I'm so looking forward to Stormy and her 38 double D going into the witness box. That's
going to be his running mate. Just imagine.
It's going to be absolutely.
What a story.
What a story.
That could have been a great April Fool, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The bad boy and the playboy bunny. That would be absolutely great. But yeah, so Trump, you'll remember, Liam, made some pretty dark quips about NATO countries not having coughed up enough and the United States having to sort of pay the lion's share. And there was certainly, as is often with a Donald, he sometimes happens on truths almost erratically, but it's completely right that we have relied on the United States to bear the burden of Europe's defence. So I suspect this defence spending increase is as much to do with making the United States think that we're committed to, and of course, vast amounts going to Ukraine.
We have been doing a deep dive into defence, though I can't think why all these lovely old military men seem so much keener to talk to you than to me.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
This week, we are delighted to welcome aboard the Rocket of Right Thinking, one of the rightest thinking and indeed most controversial British politicians. Suella Braverman is a barrister and a KC, the Conservative MP for Fareham since 2015. Suella was Attorney General from 2020 to March 2021, and again from September 2021 to 2022. In the January 2018 cabinet reshuffle, she was appointed Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for exiting the European Union as a keen Brexiteer. In November that year, she resigned in protest against Theresa May's dreadful draft Brexit means Brexit withdrawal agreement, not the last time that Suella would resign on principle. She stood as a candidate to replace Boris Johnson in July 2022. And after being eliminated from the ballot in the second round of voting, she supported Liz Truss becoming Truss's Home Secretary in 2022, and then being reinstated as Home Secretary by Rishi Sunak. But as everyone will remember, she was dismissed in November 2023 after bitter disagreements with Rishi Sunak over immigration, the plan to stop the small boats, which she said simply wouldn't work, and of course, policing of the hate marches through London. I began by asking Suella Braverman about the Safety of Rwanda Bill, which of course was finally passed earlier this week, with the Prime Minister promising to get multiple flights a month off the ground. What does Suella think the chances are that anybody will be deported to Rwanda by July?
Well, Alison, I have a lot of misgivings about the new legislation. And that's why I voiced those concerns back in November following the defeat in the Supreme Court. And then I voted against it at third reading in the House of Commons at the beginning of the year. I couldn't, in good conscience, support yet another doomed piece of legislation that is destined to fail. And I'm afraid I don't agree with the Prime Minister on this. I don't agree that this new Act of Parliament, our third Act of Parliament, will stop the boats. And that's the test. It may well be the case that we get a flight or two or even a few flights off with a low number of passengers on them to Rwanda. I think that is possible. But in order to actually deliver a deterrent effect that stops the people smuggling gangs, that stops people crossing the channel in the first place, we need regular flights, more than once a week, for example, with hundreds of passengers on those flights going to Rwanda at a large scale. That's the only way you effect a deterrence. And so I don't think we will be able to achieve that on this piece of legislation. And the fatal flaw with this new Act of Parliament is that it doesn't sufficiently exclude all of the legal claims to which you're referring. So people will still be able to bring individual claims asserting that to send them to Rwanda would be a violation of their human rights. It would harm their health. It would break up their family relations. It would expose them to some tenuous risk of torture, and all of these claims will clog up the courts. The second big problem is that this bill, this new Act of Parliament, still allows for the Strasbourg court to intervene. It does not, in terms, state that the Strasbourg court cannot issue an injunction, or it does not state, something that I would have preferred to have seen, that these injunctions issued by the Strasbourg court, these so-called pajama injunctions, we saw it in June a few years ago when the plane was on the tarmac, and at the last minute, the court in Strasbourg, an unnamed judge, no reasons were given, the UK government didn't even have a chance to make representations in that process, handed down an injunction that blocked the flight from taking off. There's nothing in this Act of Parliament that stops that from happening again. So I fear a rerun of what we saw a few years ago on the tarmac.
So Lord Cameron said today it's not necessary to leave the ECHR, European Convention on Human Rights, to stop the small boats. Do you disagree with him?
I do. I've been calling for some years now that it's necessary to leave the ECHR, and I think the case is the most compelling that it's ever been. Following what happened in June 2022 on the tarmac, we saw the interventionist politicised court stop this government from controlling its borders. But we've seen many more unacceptable extensions of the court's power into our policymaking. And in a whole host of policy areas, it's not just in immigration and asylum. We see the European Convention on Human Rights, as applied by the Strasbourg Court of Human Rights, undermining parliamentary supremacy, sovereignty, and, you know, the British people's will, as expressed at elections, to control their borders. So I do think the time has come to leave. I think we need to do it now. We've got a mandate. We've got a majority. We may not do so for a long time. We must use that opportunity. And this window of time is closing rapidly.
So, well, the PM also claimed that the backlog of asylum claims had been cleared. Now, what did he mean by that? How many have been cleared? And where are those people now?
This is a borders emergency. This is a public safety emergency. But overall, this is a national security emergency. We've had tens of thousands of people come into our country illegally. Many of these people are at large in our communities, and they're not in detention. They're not in incarceration. They are at large. And unfortunately, not all, but many of them do go on to criminal behavior involved in drugs supply and drugs dealing, violent crime. There is a real public safety issue, and there's a national security risk here. So this is an emergency, and I don't think there's any time to lose. We need to act now while we still can to actually, as I say, use our majority, use our mandate, and do what is necessary to stop the boats. There are backlogs and there are backlogs, if I can put it that way. There's the overall backlog of all the cases coming into our asylum system, even those being lodged today. And you'll never get that down to zero, because on any day, there will be some people coming into the system. So you're always going to have a flow of cases coming in, and they do take some time to process. We also have what we call the legacy backlog, which is historic cases dating up to about the end of 2022. Now, that last year, that amounted to about 100,000 cases. Now, some of those cases had been in the system for several years, 2, 3, 4 years in some instances, and there'd been very slow processing of these cases. Now, the important point to remember is that when an asylum seeker is in our Home Office system, they are being accommodated at the expense of the British taxpayer. So it's costing us £6 million a day to accommodate people. We've run out of actual bespoke asylum accommodation. So we've had to use hotels, and many, many hotels around towns and cities in the UK are being taken up by asylum seekers commissioned by the Home Office. We did succeed. When I was Home Secretary, I was really frustrated with this. And we did actually start to turn the tide on hotel use. And we started to close some of those hotels and start to use other forms of accommodation. To be honest, you know, it's a symptom of a broader problem, but it was one thing that we did manage to do logistically. But the case remains that there are still too many people in the system waiting for a decision. The asylum legacy backlog has largely been cleared through faster processing, more streamlined systems, more caseworkers, and trying to get through the cases more quickly. A large proportion of that 100,000 cases constituted people from countries like Iran or Afghanistan. And so they would have largely been granted asylum. They will then be taken off the Home Office books and be allowed to stay in the UK legally. So that's what's been happening.
But what I'm concerned about, I don't have to tell you this, official government figures show that of the 129,407 initial asylum decisions received between April 2023 and April 2024, 89,365 were substantive decisions, 56,744 granted, and 36,597 refusals. That is a grant rate of 61%. So, Ella, why is our grant rate so much higher than, say, France's? And is it safe to process so many thousands of asylum claims that quickly with presumably inadequate checks on mainly young men who have no documentation?
again, I'm afraid this comes back down to our human rights laws. So what will happen is people will say, an asylum seeker will typically say, well, I've got a human right or I've got a refugee convention right to stay in the UK. And they will typically base their claims on things like, well, I've got a family member in the UK. So that's Article 8. And if you deport me or if you refuse me asylum, I'm gonna fight it in court. And generally speaking, because we're subject to these human rights laws, the government will lose. Or they'll say, as we saw tragically earlier this year, I used to be a Muslim, but now I'm a Christian. And here's my certificate of baptism from my local vicar who signed me off as a God-fearing, church-going Christian. And I'm Christian, and if you send me back to my Muslim country of origin, I'm going to get persecuted.
Yes, I get all the reasons that people use to wangle to stay. I'm asking you, why is our grant rate three times the grant rate of France?
It's because people will largely use these grounds to seek asylum. And because we are hamstrung by European Convention rules and human rights laws, we have to grant them asylum effectively. If someone comes along and says, I'm a Christian, you've got to let me stay, it's almost impossible right now to challenge that and say, no, we're going to refuse you asylum. That's what happens. And it's because of the human rights laws. It's because of the case law that's been borne out of these courts and the laws that we're subject to. We haven't changed them sufficiently, that the decision makers in the Home Office just know that if they refuse, it will get appealed and then the judge will allow it. So that's how the system works. And I say this having...
So just to clarify, France must surely be subject to the same legislation as us.
Well, they take actually a more restrictive view of some of these matters. We've got a particular combination of the European Convention on Human Rights, the Refugee Convention as well, the Human Rights Act. That's something the French don't have. So we've incorporated these laws into British laws. And we've got the added factor of a very expansive judicial review regime and, frankly, quite activist judges and very well-coordinated NGOs and lawyers. I used to raise this issue with my opposite number, the French Interior Minister, Gérald Darmanin, quite a lot. I used to say, listen, don't you have similar problems with, you know, vexatious claims and unmerited claims based on human rights? He would say no. He didn't really recognize that. And I think that's because the French courts have a very different legal system. They have a much more restrictive system when it comes to giving out welfare to asylum seekers, giving out accommodation to asylum seekers, and granting asylum in the first place based on grounds like religion or family life rights. So they do have a very different legal ecosystem compared to the one we have in the UK. I think we have the worst of both worlds. We are subject to the European Convention, but we've also added to it through our own domestic laws and our judicial review frameworks.
When you wrote your resignation letter, very spirited resignation letter to the Prime Minister last November, you recalled, Suella, how you said you would serve as Rishi Sunak's Home Secretary if he agreed to a number of conditions. Now, they included reducing legal immigration by increasing salary thresholds on work visas, reforming international students' routes, and so on. Legal immigration last year was 745,000, a deafening number, quite frankly, and one which will make a lot of former Conservatives not vote Conservative. Do you personally feel let down or betrayed by those guarantees that Rishi Sunak gave you?
I agreed to support the Prime Minister on the condition that he agreed to make those changes to legal migration. I was incredibly concerned about spiraling levels of net migration. I voted to leave the European Union in 2016 and campaigned for Brexit because I wanted to lower overall numbers. The 2019 manifesto made a pledge to lower overall numbers. And yet, 3 or 4 years into this parliament, we were moving in precisely the opposite direction. So I was very frustrated in 2022 about what had gone on previously. And it was a condition of my support for the Prime Minister. As time went on, it became apparent that he wasn't really interested in this subject. It took me about a year to even get a face-to-face meeting with him on proposals. I was left to sending several letters to him with the proposals in them. And in the end, he, under duress, I would say, did ultimately announce some measures at the end of last year, but only after, you know, unprecedented levels of net migration, I was able to speak more freely outside government and say what a disgrace the situation had become in a way that I would never have been able to do had I been around the cabinet table. And ultimately, I was met with a lot of resistance from the economic departments, from the education department, from the health department. You know, there's an institutional view in Whitehall that more migration is better for the economy. It's better for universities. It's better for the NHS. It's better for our country, full stop. There's no acknowledgement whatsoever within the Treasury or within government about the costs of migration, about the impacts on our resources like schools and housing, or on the impacts on social and cultural cohesion. And I think that's why the British people have voted time and time again to lower migration. And it has been a failure of government to deliver on that promise so far.
Well, I'm very interested to hear that the Prime Minister wasn't particularly interested in immigration when it was comes out as the top concern of Conservative voters. Now, another reason you left government was over what you called the two-tier policing of the pro-Palestine marches in London. You wrote in your letter to Rishi Sunak, "I have become hoarse, urging you to consider legislation to ban the hate marches and help stem the rising tide of racism and intimidation and terrorist glorification now threatening community cohesion." So Ella, this week there's been a major row, I know you'll have seen that, about the policing of the marches, with one police officer accusing Gideon Falter of the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism of being openly Jewish and therefore a provocation to the marchers. What's your take on that form of words and on the way this thing you warned about is unfolding?
It's wholly unacceptable. We've now seen 6 months of these approximately weekly marches and hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets, glorifying terrorism, chanting jihad, celebrating anti-Semitism, being intimidating, abusive, and threatening, scaling war memorials, firing flares, waving flags with anti-Semitic tropes. And we've seen the police turn a blind eye. And it's a totally unacceptable example of double standards. And I saw that in November, and I see it now in April, glaringly. And the incident last weekend shone a light on this double standard, this unacceptable two-tier policing, whereby the police are totally abandoning their duty to police without fear or favour. There's far too much fear, and I'm afraid there's even more favouritism when it comes to policing these marches.
Should Sir Mark Rowley, the Metropolitan Commissioner, resign?
I have regrettably come to the sad conclusion that yes, he must, because we've seen this go on for such a protracted period of time. There's been meetings, there's been the Prime Minister speaking on the steps of Downing Street. They've announced a new law. They've been talking about it, and yet it still keeps getting worse. And why I believe we need a change of leadership is because there have been big errors. There's been an error of strategy. The police have adopted the approach to these marches that they adopt when they are policing football fans and football crowds, whereby in that scenario, they choose one group and they say, look, we're going to allow the larger group to dominate and we're going to form a cordon around them. And any other smaller group or individual who comes along, we're just going to wave them out of the way. You can't apply that approach to what we're seeing play out with these marches, because these marches are about a very complex and sensitive and emotive issue relating to politics in the Middle East. They're about race, religion, and identity. People are dying out in the Middle East, and people feel very strongly on both sides of the debate. And you can't treat them like one team or another. You can't treat them like Man United or Chelsea fans. This is wholly different. And so they've taken the wrong approach strategically. They've chosen a side. And how do you think that makes Jewish people feel around the country? I don't think they've considered how this makes Jewish people feel, an ethnic minority in our country. And if this policeman had spoken to anybody else of a different ethnicity, a black person, an Asian person, a Muslim person, in the way that he spoke to that Jewish man last week, there would be universal outrage. And I'm sure Sir Mark would no longer be in his post anymore. But because it's directed towards Jews, it's somehow more acceptable. And institutionally, and there's a collective turning of the blind eye, turning of a blind eye to this flagrant racism and anti-Semitism. That's wholly unacceptable. And that's why I felt so angry and heartbroken by that injustice that I saw and the injustice I've seen play out on our streets month after month, that I have come to that conclusion to speak out about what must now happen.
Finally, you are the daughter of proud Asian immigrants. You grew up in a corner of Northwest London, not too far from co-pilot Halligan, as he constantly reminds me. I think you went to the same primary school, not at exactly the same time, but clearly it produces some marvellous, resolute individuals. Suella, why do you feel so strongly as the child of immigrants about controlling immigration?
Oh, that's a great question. And you're right. Yes, Liam and I share a primary school and from a similar part of London. And that part of London, Wembley in Brent, has traditionally been an area of deprivation, actually. It's very multi-ethnic, multi-faith, more so now than it was even when I was growing up. I feel so passionate about controlling migration because I believe it's the basic duty of a country to be able to control who is coming in to the country and to know who is in the country for public safety reasons and national security reasons. I think it's also, and this is why I was so compelled to take the difficult decision back in 2016 to vote to leave the European Union. I was a new MP. I'd only been in Parliament for a year when I had to have the conversation with David Cameron and say, you know, my heart is telling me to vote for Brexit. I did that because I think that it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable for our country with limited resources to accommodate millions and millions of people every year. You know, the forecast is from the ONS that in the next 8 to 10 years, we're set to receive over 6 million more net pull into the British population. That is going to require many, many more doctors and nurses, many, many more school places, many more homes. We struggle to provide sufficient resources for the population as it stands today. So how on earth can we build, you know, 5 more Birminghams around the country in the next 10 years? That is not realistic. And therefore, from an allocation of resources point of view, it is essential that we get a grip on migration now. It's also important because of cultural cohesion and social cohesion. The pace of immigration has been far too quick in recent years, and people are coming to our country who don't necessarily share our values because they don't want to participate in British life or take part in British integration. They are living parallel lives and contributing to a fraying of the social fabric. That's very dangerous for a country. We all need to be united behind an inspiring and common vision. In order to do that, we all need to identify what that vision looks like. And we all need to sometimes make some sacrifices. But if you've got areas of our country where certain communities are demanding that Sharia law be imposed on communities or demanding that blasphemy laws be respected, we can't criticize Islam, or if we've got people coming into the country and they're not speaking English as a basic requirement, they're not going to be able to take part fully in British society. And I think that is very worrying for the future of our country.
Suella, thank you for joining us. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
A very strong interview there, Alison, with the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, I think in flamethrower mode when it comes to her political rhetoric. She's clearly very exercised about the way she feels she was thwarted while Home Secretary. And it's clear to me that she will be a leadership contender. And her comments to you on that subject reflect the fact that so many senior Tories now, it's not about the election, it's about what happens after the election who becomes the leader after the election. And that positioning is now very much underway.
I really wanted to ask you, Liam, because I know you have had a very special friendship with the marvellous Frank Field, who has sadly just died, a real giant among MPs, that sort of rare breed, a Labour MP who just felt wasn't party pre, but was incredibly principled and always stood up, particularly for children and the oppressed. What are your feelings today? I mean, you must be feeling very sad.
I am, Alison. We're recording on Wednesday, aren't we? And I learned, like everybody else, about Frank's death just this morning. I'll be writing and speaking much more about it over the coming days. But just briefly here on Planet Normal, Frank Field, who I met when I was a young academic, I then covered his very short tenure as Minister for Welfare Reform in the early days of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's government in the late 1990s when I was a political correspondent on the FT. And we've since been involved in various research projects and I've stayed in close touch with him. He's somebody who, in my view, was too clever for politics. And I don't mean clever in a pejorative sense. I mean intelligent and wise. He was a Labour MP from a working class background in London, very humble origins, grammar school boy who got himself to university. And yet he didn't like taking the party line on anything. He liked to make up his own mind about reforms. And that's why he was widely respected across the House of Commons and indeed across Parliament and the broader country as an independent-minded MP whose values were very much Labour. He founded the Child Poverty Action Group and then the Low Pay Unit, two real landmark organisations campaigning against poverty and massively influencing public policy. So he was very much Labour in terms of the outputs that he wanted, but he didn't always agree with the sort of left-wing statist view about how you get there. A very innovative thinker who was basically drummed out of government by then an extremely all-powerful chancellor, who, in my view, didn't like the fact that there may be someone in the room who was smarter than he was. I mean, friends of Gordon Brown may contest that publicly, even if in their mind they know that it's true. Frank Field was one of those people who, even though he was only a backbencher for the vast majority of the 40 years he spent in Parliament, proud MP for Birkenhead that he was, even though he was politically obscure in terms of the posts he held, his reputation across the country was enormous. And there will be many, many cross-party tributes on our airwaves and in our newspapers over the days to come.
Yeah, lovely to hear from you about him. One feels a world is a less safe and kind place for his departure. Now it's time for our listener emails. The messages you send to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Please keep them coming. We really love reading your thoughts and we learn so much from you, the citizens of Planet Normal. This is from Carmen. Dear Alison and Liam, I read with deep sadness, but no surprise, Alison's article calling for the resignation of Sir Mark Rowley and of Alison's experience sitting in on the debate at the National Jewish Assembly. My partner of 20 years is an atheist Jew, doesn't keep kosher. To all intents and purposes, he's as British as I am with my deep Stockport roots. His family came to the UK in the late 1880s, and in more immediate family, grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts and uncles and so on, escaped the horrors of the Holocaust. Despite all this, even now in his mid-60s, he knows he could not bear to visit Auschwitz. It would be too much for him. So you can imagine how he feels at the moment. With every week that passes, he feels more and more depressed and scared in the country of his birth, the country of his parents' birth. He has never visited Israel, but for the first time ever, he has seriously considered the option of moving there. It sounds ridiculous. We both have health conditions. We don't do lots of going out, almost never into central London. We live in a fairly affluent area of North London, surrounded by a higher than average number of Jews, and for that matter, Iranians and Palestinians, who are long-standing friends and neighbours. The genuine fear my husband feels points to quite how bad things have become, and Sir Mark Rowley has allowed this to happen. It is him and Sadiq Khan and senior civil servants who have given carte blanche to these hate marches, to blatant anti-Semitism, to mob rule. Just as an aside, isn't it odd how the police were sent into yesterday's St. George's Day Patriots March in riot gear, which is always inflammatory, but apparently they cannot control the Saturday mobs, so simply appease. More two-tier policing. Yes, Sir Mark Rowley has to go now, says Carmen, but there needs to be more done and quickly to reassure British Jews, or Britain will lose a section of society it can ill afford to lose and should not be driving out. Keep up the good work, guys. Carmen.
Very powerful email there from Carmen. This is from Tom, not his real name. Dear Alison and Liam, I'm an unpaid chairman of a village hall in the Midlands. On Saturday, I received a call at 7:45 a.m. The burglar alarm was going off due to a power spike. Power spikes are common due to the multiplicity of electricity sources required to keep the grid energised and the constant switching between wind, solar, Belgian coal, French nuclear, UK gas, etc., etc. As a lad, I lived around here, within a few miles of three Trent Valley coal-fired stations and numerous coal mines. These power spikes never happened in the 80s, 90s and the noughties. The mines and power stations are now long gone. My village hall's finances are crippled by expensive electricity. Some members of our local community can't afford to heat their homes. We received a £3,000 grant from the power industry to run a warm space soup kitchen from January to March of this year. A local solar farm has been built so it can be connected to the national grid adjacent to the abandoned power station. The equipment was doubtless produced in China, where they're still building new coal-fired power stations. So food production has ceased in a country already reliant on food imports and offering little sunshine during the winter when we face peak electricity demand. This huge solar farm is now also giving grants to local charities funded by the green taxes on everyone's electricity bills that we can't afford to pay. This is insanity piled upon insanity. Please, please, please let this end. From Tom.
Well said, Tom. Seeing these energy bills go up and up is going to really put a spoke in the wheels, I think, of all the net zero. This is from Adrian, speaking to me in Welsh, Liam.
Oh, my God.
Bore da, Alison.
Yours the steam. Cup of tea and Ivor's boiler.
There's more to Wales than Ivor the engine, Halligan.
Not for me, there isn't. Phil Bennett and Ivor the engine with a bit of JPR Williams, maybe. Oh, and John Conte, Shirley Bassey, Tom Jones.
Dylan Thomas, do not go gently into that good night. Right, let's get back to Adrian. Bore da, Alison. Good morning, Adrian. Firstly, thanks for the podcast. I'm an avid listener, says Adrian. I'm getting increasingly frustrated that, especially following the Hillary Cass review, the Welsh government is getting a free pass on the gender identity idiocy, whilst England, Northern Ireland and Scotland are being held up for scrutiny. As you may know, says Adrian, our homegrown Labour loons are neck deep in this scandalous racket with the education system and the NHS 100% complicit. The 2022 Welsh Relationship and Sexuality Education Curriculum was co-written with Stonewall, makes no mention of the words man, woman, boy or girl, and is compulsory for all Welsh children. The Gender Wales website cheerfully announces that most children who are referred will go on to hormone therapy and surgery. What you won't know is that following the Telegraph investigation last year into English schools, I asked my member of the Senate, Jeremy Miles, to confirm that the gender identity hypothesis was not being taught as if it were fact, and to confirm that parents like me would be informed if a child were questioning their gender. He never replied personally, but Curriculum for Wales refused multiple times to answer those two simple questions. I still have the email trail. Someone needs to shed a light on the Welsh government, and I can't think of anyone better. Would you please consider looking into this? Best regards, Adrian. We'll add it to our long list of gender identity madness, Adrian.
Velma's magnifying glass will be wielding in a certain direction. Did Velma have a magnifying glass? I'm not so sure. And on that bombshell, that's it from Planet Normal for another week as we leave our sanctuary of sweet reason, our flying refuge of reason views. Email of the week is Alison's turn.
I'm going to give it to Carmen and her lovely Jewish husband. Please stay. We need you.
Send in your address, Carmen, to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk and put mug winner in the subject heading of the email, and we'll send you a rare as rocking horse poo Planet Normal mug. And finally, drum roll, co-pilot.
Da-da-da-da.
Some news about Planet Normal. So, dear readers, we'll soon reach our 200th episode of Planet Normal. Hooray!
Yay.
And to mark this occasion, the podcast will be recorded at a live event on Wednesday, the 29th of May, at Cadogan Hall, close to the Telegraph's HQ in Victoria, starting at 7 p.m.
That's right. Liam and I are so proud to have reached this amazing milestone, but we couldn't have done it without you, our wonderful, wise and extremely loyal Planet Normal listeners. And we'll be joined at that wonderful event on Wednesday, the 29th of May, by some terrific guests. Details of that coming shortly.
Tickets will go on sale for this event from 10 a.m. this coming Friday via the Telegraph's website for Telegraph subscribers in the first instance. And of course, the recorded podcast will be released as normal on Thursday, so no one will miss out when it comes to marking the 200th anniversary. And as we speed away from our beloved Planet Normal and the madness of Planet Earth comes back into view, thanks as ever to our producers, Isabel Bouchard, Cass Ho and Louisa Wells. Stay safe and in touch with us and with each other. Until next week, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.